Chapter 22. Passing avalanche music very familiar to his ear, for he had heard it every afternoon at this hour since the day he first came courting this child of the earth, who lives in the sky, and that day is far, yes, for he was at this pleasant sport before the Middle Ages drifted by him in the valley, before the Romans marched past, and before the antique and recordless barbarians fished and hunted here, and wondered who he might be, and were probably afraid of him, and before primeval man himself, just emerged from his four-footed estate, stepped out upon this plain, first sample of his race, 1,000 centuries ago, and cast a glad eye up there, judging he had found a brother human being and consequently something to kill, and before the big saurians wallowed here, still some eons earlier. Oh yes, a day so far back, that the eternal sun was present to see that first visit. A day so far back, that neither tradition nor history was born yet, and a whole weary eternity must come and go before the restless little creature, of whose face this stupendous shadow face was the prophecy, would arrive in the earth, and begin his shabby career, and think of a big thing. Oh, indeed yes. When you talk about your poor Roman, and Egyptian day before yesterday antiquities, you should choose a time, when the hoary shadow face of the Junker is not by. It antedates all antiquities known or imaginable, for it was here the world itself created the theater of future antiquities. And it is the only witness with a human face that was there to see the marvel, and remains to us a memorial of it. By 440 p.m. the nose of the shadow, is perfect and is beautiful. It is black, and is powerfully marked against the upright canvas of glowing snow, and covers hundreds of acres of that resplendent surface. Meantime shadow number 2 has been creeping out well to the rear of the face west of it, and at 5 o'clock has assumed a shape, that has rather a poor and rude semblance of a shoe. Meantime, also, the great shadow face has been gradually changing for 20 minutes, and now, 5 p.m., it is becoming a quite fair portrait of Roscoe Conkling. The likeness is there, and is unmistakable. The goatee is shortened, now, and has an end. Formerly it hadn't any, but ran off eastward and arrived nowhere. By 6 p.m. the face has dissolved and gone, and the goatee has become what looks like the shadow of a tower with a pointed roof, and the shoe had turned into, what the printers call a fist with a finger pointing. If I were now imprisoned on a mountain summit 100 miles northward of this point, and was denied a timepiece, I could get along well enough from 4 till 6 on clear days, for I could keep trace of the time by the changing shapes of these mighty shadows of the Virgin's front, the most stupendous style I am acquainted with, the oldest clock in the world by a couple of million years. I suppose I should not have noticed the forms of the shadows, if I hadn't the habit of hunting for faces in the clouds and in mountain cracks, a sort of amusement which is very entertaining, even when you don't find any, and brilliantly satisfying when you do. I have searched through several bushels of photographs of the Junker here, but found only one with the face in it, and in this case it was not strictly recognizable as a face, which was evidence that the picture was taken before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and also evidence that all the photographers have persistently overlooked one of the most fascinating features of the Junker show. I say fascinating, because if you once detect a human face produced on a great plan by unconscious nature, you never get tired of watching it. At first you can't make another person see it at all, but after he has made it out once he can't see anything else afterward. The King of Greece is a man who goes around quietly enough when off duty. One day this summer he was traveling in an ordinary first-class compartment, just in his other suit, the one which he works the realm in, when he is at home, and so he was not looking like anybody in particular, but a good deal like everybody in general. By and by a hearty and healthy German-American got in, and opened up a frank and interesting and sympathetic conversation with him, and asked him a couple of thousand questions about himself, which the King answered good-naturedly, but in a more or less indefinite way, as to private particulars. Where do you live when you are at home?
In Greece.
Greece. Well, now, that is just astonishing. Born there?
No.
Do you speak Greek?
Yes.
Now, ain't that strange? I never expected to live to see that.
What is your trade?
I mean, how do you get your living? What is your line of business?
Well, I hardly know how to answer.
I am only a kind of foreman, on a salary, and the business, well, is a very general kind of business.
Yes, I understand, general jobbing, little of everything, anything that there's money in.
That's about it,
yes.
Are you traveling for the house now?
Well, partly, but not entirely.
Of course I do a stroke of business, if it falls in the way,
good.
I like that in you.
That's me every time.
Go on.
I was only going to say I am off on my vacation now.
Well, that's all right. No harm in that.
A man works all the better for a little let-up now and then.
Not that I've been used to having it myself, for I haven't.
I reckon this is my first.
I was born in Germany, and when I was a couple of weeks old shipped to America, and I've been there ever since, and that's 64 years by the watch. I'm an American in principle and a German at heart, and it's the boss combination.
Well, how do you get along?
As a rule, pretty fair.
I've a rather large family there, that's it, big family, and trying to raise them on the salary.
Now, what did you go to do that for?
Well, I thought, of course you did.
You were young and confident, and thought you could branch out, and make things go with a whirl, and here you are,
you see.
But never mind about that. I'm not trying to discourage you.
Dear me.
I've been just where you are myself.
You've got good grit, there's good stuff in you, I can see that.
You got a wrong start, that's the whole trouble.
But you hold your grip, and we'll see what can be done.
Your case ain't half as bad as it might be. You are going to come out all right, I'm bail for that.
Boys and girls?
My family?
Yes, some of them are boys, and the rest girls.
It's just as I expected.
But that's all right, and it's better so, anyway.
What are the boys doing learning a trade?
Well, no, I thought, it's a big mistake.
It's the biggest mistake you ever made.
You see that in your own case.
A man ought always to have a trade to fall back on.
Now, I was harness maker at first.
Did that prevent me from becoming one of the biggest brewers in America?
Oh no.
I always had the harness trick to fall back on in rough weather.
Now, if you had learned how to make harness, however, it's too late now,
too late.
But it's no good plan to cry over spilt milk.
But as to the boys, you see what's to become of them, if anything happens to you?
It has been my idea, to let the eldest one succeed me,
oh, come.
Suppose the firm don't want him?
I hadn't thought of that, but, now, look here, you want to get right down to business and stop dreaming.
You are capable of immense things, man.
You can make a perfect success in life.
All you want is somebody to steady you, and boost you along on the right road.
Do you own anything in the business?
No, not exactly, but if I continue to give satisfaction, I suppose I can keep
your place,
yes.
Well, don't you depend on anything of the kind.
They'll bounce you the minute you get a little old and worked out,
they'll do it sure.
Can't you manage somehow to get into the firm?
That's the great thing, you know.
I think it is doubtful,
very doubtful.
That's bad,
yes, and unfair too.
Do you suppose that, if I should go there, and have a talk with your people,
look here, do you think you could run a brewery?
I have never tried, but I think I could do it after a little familiarity with the business.
The German was silent for some time.
He did a good deal of thinking, and the king waited curiously to see what the result was going to be.
Finally the German said,
"My mind's made up.
You leave that crowd, you'll never amount to anything there.
In these old countries they never give a fellow a show.
Yes, you come over to America, come to my place in Rochester, bring the family along.
You shall have a show in the business and the foremanship, besides. George, you said your name was George? I'll make a man of you. I give you my word. You've never had a chance here, but that's all going to change. By gracious, I'll give you a lift that'll make your hair curl. At the Shrine of Street Wagner, Barath, August 2D, 1891, it was at Nuremberg that we struck the inundation of music mad strangers that was rolling down upon Barath. It had been long since we had seen such multitudes of excited and struggling people. It took a good half hour to pack them and pair them into the train, and it was the longest train we have yet seen in Europe. Nuremberg had been witnessing this sort of experience a couple of times a day for about 2 weeks. It gives one an impressive sense of the magnitude of this biennial pilgrimage. For a pilgrimage is what it is. The devotees come from the very ends of the earth to worship their prophet in his own Kaaba, in his own Mecca. If you are living in New York, or San Francisco, or Chicago, or anywhere else in America, and you conclude, by the middle of May, that you would like to attend the Barath Opera 2 months and a half later, you must use the cable, and get about it immediately, or you will get no seats, and you must cable for lodgings too. Then if you are lucky, you will get seats in the last row and lodgings in the fringe of the town. If you stop to write, you will get nothing. There were plenty of people in Nuremberg when we passed through who had come on pilgrimage without first securing seats and lodgings. They had found neither in Barath. They had walked Barath streets a while in sorrow, then had gone to Nuremberg and found neither beds nor standing room, and had walked those quaint streets all night, waiting for the hotels to open and empty their guests into trains, and so make room for these, their defeated brethren and sisters in the faith. They had endured from 30 to 40 hours railroading on the continent of Europe, with all which that implies of worry, fatigue, and financial impoverishment, and all they had got, and all they were to get for it was handiness and accuracy in kicking themselves, acquired by practice in the back streets of the two towns, when other people were in bed. For back they must go over that unspeakable journey with their pious mission unfulfilled. These humiliated outcasts had the frozy and unbrushed and apologetic look of wet cats, and their eyes were glazed with drowsiness, their bodies were adroop from crown to sole, and all kind-hearted people refrained from asking them if they had been to Barath and failed to connect, as knowing they would lie. We reached here, Barath, about mid-afternoon of a rainy Saturday. We were of the wise, and had secured lodgings and opera seats months in advance. I am not a musical critic, and did not come here to write essays about the operas and deliver judgment upon their merits. The little children of Barath could do that with a finer sympathy and a broader intelligence than one. I only care to bring 4 or 5 pilgrims to the operas, pilgrims able to appreciate them and enjoy them. What I write about the performance, to put in my odd time, would be offered to the public as merely a cat's view of a king, and not of didactic value. Next day, which was Sunday, we left for the opera house, that is to say, the Wagner Temple, a little after the middle of the afternoon. The great building stands all by itself, grand and lonely, on a high ground outside the town. We were warned that if we arrived after 4 o'clock we should be obliged to pay $2, and a half extra by way of fine. We saved that, and it may be remarked here that this is the only opportunity that Europe offers of saving money. There was a big crowd in the grounds about the building, and the ladies' dresses took the sun with fine effect. I do not mean to intimate that the ladies were in full dress, for that was not so. The dresses were pretty, but neither sex was in evening dress. The interior of the building is simple, severely so, but there is no occasion for color and decoration, since the people sit in the dark. The auditorium has the shape of a keystone, with the stage at the narrow end. There is an aisle on each side, but no aisle in the body of the house. Each row of seats extends in an unbroken curve from one side of the house to the other. There are 7 entrance doors on each side of the theater and 4 at the butt, 18 doors to admit and emit 1,650 persons. The number of the particular door by which you are to enter the house or leave it is printed on your ticket, and you can use no door but that one. Thus, crowding and confusion are impossible. Not so many as 100 people use any one door. This is better than having the usual and useless, elaborate fireproof arrangements. It is the model theater of the world. It can be emptied while the second hand of a watch makes its circuit. It would be entirely safe, even if it were built of Lucifer matches. If your seat is near the center of a row, and you enter late, you must work your way along a rank of about 25 ladies and gentlemen to get to it. Yet this causes no trouble, for everybody stands up until all the seats are full, and the filling. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.